Sassy Jack Stitchery is proud to be a sponsor of Fiber Talk. We so appreciate all the wonderful new things we learn, the familiar friends we meet online, and the fabulously talented artists that Gary and team introduce us to each week. Sassy Jack Stitchery is turning 5 next year. We opened our brick and mortar shop in 2017, and we are ramping up for a fabulous year of celebration in 2022. We'll be sharing more of our birthday plans with you as we work our way through the fall and navigate moving into our new shop home in our beautiful old 1878 Folk Victorian. We plan to be in our new shop home in Woodfin, North Carolina, just a few miles up the same street as our old shop before the year is out. We're hoping to have that beautiful old house decorated for Christmas in late November and time to share our holiday joy and our hope for the new year with all of you. In the meantime, we are rich in linens and threads and charts and notions, all ready to wing their way to your own little stitching nest just in time for cooler weather. You can find us on our website at sassyjackstitchery.com and keep up with us on our social media on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Thank you for your continued support of our shop and of this wonderful gathering place we know as Fiber Talk.
Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needleworkers and artists and people who do things creative. Yeah. our artist this week from Thistle Threads, Tricia Nguyen. Tricia, welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much, Gary and Beth. Good to be here.
Yes. All right. So this was your idea, Tricia. We're going to, this is not your normal Fiber Talk podcast. We're going to address the topic about perfection being the enemy of good and or progress.
Yes.
Yes. I think I'm guilty. Yes. I think I'm quite guilty.
I think a lot of people are guilty of this.
Yeah. So, all right. So Tricia, you interact with stitchers a lot. This whole topic must come up, especially with your caskets and some of the things that you teach. This whole thing must come up a lot. I mean, I know I do it. I get hung up on perfection and I suck the fun right out of the needlework.
Yeah, I think that one of the problems we have out there is that we have a lot of photographs. We have a lot of small photographs. Sometimes they're close in. Sometimes they're not close in enough to see what's going on. And people get not a true idea of what historic or regular needlework looks like. And so they have this concept in their head of what they're trying to aim for, which might not necessarily be accurate. And I get this all the time. I get emails from stitchers who want to, let's say, join one of the courses, especially one of the casket courses. And instead of just registering for a course, the stitcher seems to feel the need to email me an actual stitching resume and ask if they're good enough to make a casket. You know, they've got a master craftsman in this, their Royal School that, they studied with this teacher and that teacher. And sometimes they even send me photographs of their embroidery and beg me, am I good enough to do this? And that just really kind of shocks me, upsets me quite a bit that especially an area of embroidery that I'm teaching, which was essentially done by 12-year-old girls as one of their first or maybe third projects in their life. And here all of these stitchers with really decades of experience just seem to feel that they're not good enough. And that bothers me.
Is that, yeah, because now it makes me wonder if we've created an environment that drives that. Because years and years ago when I, you know, stitching, I think most of us stitched in a vacuum unless you belong to an EGA chapter or something like that. I mean, I just stitched in a vacuum and I go to the store and get supplies, but that was it. I didn't interact with any needleworkers. And so what I did is what I did. And, you know, I didn't really have anything to compare to because there was no internet. There was no email, you know, no texting of pictures and that kind of thing. But today there's all of that. Is it an environmental thing that drives this, or is it just people feeling inadequate?
I think it's a little of everything. I think that this was going on, you know, decades ago before we got social media, but it has kind of increased even more more recently. Part of it is there has been a need in the last several decades for groups who their business model is making commercial embroideries, professional embroideries, right? And, you know, all great for all of them. I have no problem with any of them. But they found that their markets from the professional embroidery side were starting to shrink. So they needed to concentrate some effort on the domestic or the hobby embroiderer in order to stay alive so that they could do their commercial embroideries. And, you know, an example of which would be the Kurenkai School in Japan, which was became open to American stitchers in the late 1980s. There was a enormous dip and still is in kimono wearing in Japan. And so they started teaching hobby embroiderers in Japan how to do their form of commercial obi embroidery. And then Americans got involved as well. And so this form of embroidery was kind of pushed out in order to keep this group alive. But their really their style of embroidery and their method of teaching is all about professional embroidery. Mm-hmm. And that's not the same thing as a home embroiderer is doing. They're trying to do something for the love of it, maybe, or an interest area. But because of the need for the perfection of a professional embroiderer, you want, you know, maybe five or six people to be working on the same piece of embroidery and nobody to be able to tell the difference between those people. So therefore, there is a rigidity to it. And I think that that has been misinterpreted by the hobby embroiderer as to be, quote, the right way. It's not necessarily the right way. It's designed to get a uniform appearance for a particular kind of embroidery.
Yeah, because that's manufacturing in many ways. That's just pure manufacturing, and the more hands, the better. So, but yeah, I can see how that gets incorrectly translated to what hobbyists do. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's not, there's nothing, I'm not criticizing what Kurenkai has. I was a student of theirs when I was 12. But you need to recognize it as a hobby embroiderer for what they are, what their intent is. Their intent is to produce embroiderers that are uniform in type, not necessarily to produce creative artists, let's say.
Right.
And so what they do, you know, Royal School, et cetera, they do tremendously well. But I think that the hobby embroiderer misinterprets the intention behind it and then, you know, looks at their own work, which may be done for to try to express an idea, let's say, and say that it's not worthy because it doesn't look like that particular style of embroidery.
Yeah, well, and that's the there's the thing there. The Royal School, now, you know, they teach everybody the same way because they want everybody to be able to sit down with a piece of cloth, the same piece of cloth, and all stitch on it and have it work out. And I just a few weeks ago did a show with Karen Teresi, who is a top flight tambour beading person. And, you know, that's the purpose of that is we need to crank out garments that have been embellished. And we need, you know, to have two or three people working on it at once and need it to all look uniform. But that, yeah, that's a whole different world than what, you know, Beth and you and I do in terms of stitching.
Right. Exactly. And as I said, because of the demand for these custom embroidered objects has gone down, they have needed to pivot in order to teach more to the hobbyist embroiderer. And as I said, because they have a particular point of view, it gets misinterpreted internalized with whatever you mentioned insecurities, internalized with the insecurities that already exist in each one of us.
Right. And this desire to reach a certain level, I think, too. I think, you know, you look at, you know, when I look at Japanese embroidery and it just, it seems all, every stitch is just perfect. And you think, well, can I achieve that? And I think there's this fear that, oh, well, I'll never measure up sort of thing.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking today about this topic a little bit, and I have a little bit of a unique view because I've kind of been a failure all my life. I'm dyslexic, and so when I was very young, pretty much everybody told me I was uneducatable, and put me in the corner in classrooms. And clearly, that kind of I overcame that when I was young, because at some point I realized that, well, I do seem to know what I'm doing on something. And so then kind of ignored this whole measure up type of concept. And that really has allowed me to, you know, take on new areas in embroidery, you know, per se, or other areas, and go at it, because I wasn't really caring as much about what other people thought.
Yeah. Okay. So have you gone back to those people just to, never mind.
Oh, there's sometimes a desire.
Yeah. Well, and see, I bet there is. Yeah. Burning desire. Yeah.
Well, there was actually a group of teachers that had a betting pool that I'd fail out of college my first year.
No.
Yes. Yes. And I went back, and what my math teacher was very excited. She said to me, well, how did you do at MIT the first year? And I told her, and she says, I've won the bet. And I went, what? And then she told me, I think she told me partially because she knew me well enough to know that it would make me so mad that not only would I get my degree, but I'd probably go to graduate school. It did.
Wow, that's a sad statement about some teachers, but that's too bad.
It is. Yeah. But I think that I don't want to be down on organizations like, you know, Lesage or Japanese Embroidery or Royal School. They have a really valuable place in what we do, because they are keeping a technical excellence up. And if you want to learn how to make something look a particular way, all for you to go and get that knowledge. But, you know, you kind of have to also stand back and say, are they evaluating, you know, am I allowing them to evaluate me and tell me that I'm not worth something?
Yeah.
And kind of step away from that particular part of it.
Yeah.
And take the amazing training. I mean, Japanese embroidery is the most wonderful training for understanding how to manipulate silk. I recommend it to many people, but at the same time, I don't use it as a validation.
And you know, another factor that plays into this, and I was cautioned to never bring it up in a show because I would get myself in trouble, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. because the issue that I've seen a lot and heard a lot, and of course, as a male, I'm not entitled to talk about this, but I'll bring it up and let you guys talk about it, is this kind of this undercurrent, inherent lack of confidence that we see in primarily female stitchers that bothers me, that, you know, that I'm not good enough, I can't do that. And yes, you are.
I'm thrilled you're bringing this up.
Thank you. Because... Thank you. Thank you.
Because I know you know, Gary, that I have a robotics team in my basement.
Yes.
And so I'm teaching engineering to kids starting at about 6 to 8 years old. And oh my God, do we see this confidence gap, and I see how it even develops. And it just pervades female culture and female life in a way that just makes me almost sick to my stomach. Because I've watched these girls, young girls who are interested in science and engineering and math, start out super excited and creative and idea generating, and how once they hit about middle school, the forces around them for socialization of girls and the way we talk to girls about their skills just puts them into a box and makes them, you know, I have some girls on my team right now who are seniors in high school, and they have gastrointestinal issues from stress.
Ugh.
That are just unbelievable. Whereas they were this happy, fun, creative, super high achieving math girls when they were 8 years old. and here, you know, I've been encouraging, and even their parents have been encouraging, but the world puts this word on girls all the time, perfect. And I see this, let's say, and parents do it without even thinking, because it's the way we talk to girls and boys. So a parent of a boy will come downstairs and say, well, how did it go today? And he'll say, well, we tried to build this arm on the robot and fell off, whatever. And the parent will say, well, you'll have to try again next time. The parent of a girl will come downstairs and say, you know, Jane, were you perfect today?
Ugh.
And it got to the point where I had to start taking people aside and say, no, we don't, we actually celebrate failure here, because that's what engineering is. It's just a series of failures to show you what the right way was to do this. And it's made them all pull back. And I see that once you get to the point where they're here, they're almost 18 years old, and now they're going to launch into the world, and they've got this enormous confidence gap that has developed. And it's not just in the engineering area, it's not just the way the whole being asked if you're perfect or told that you need to strive for perfection. It also has to do with how much time you're allowed to spend on it, because girls are pulled off for things to be involved in girl culture, like sleepovers and stuff like that, dances. And if they don't do them, then they're ostracized. Boys cannot do them, and it's right. considered normal. So that also contributes to this, and very seriously.
And then you have the whole culture of, and I'm going to bring this up because I think it contributes to it, this whole culture of beauty and fashion. And so if you're like, I have never cared about clothing. My mind is more engineer minded. And so my sisters would say, we've got to go shopping for clothes. And I'm like, but why? My clothes don't have holes in them. You know, they're serviceable. But there's that, if when you're that teenage in college years, all of a sudden that appearance that there, whereas guys, because I have two boys who are very, very engineering, you know, they could care less. As long as they're clean and don't have holes, they're good, you know? You know?
Yeah.
Well, they're good to go. But I remember being that same age.
Yeah.
And that time suck that's there. So you're not spending time on your science, your math. You've got to go do, you know, the girl going to the mall thing. I don't know what girls do now, but you yeah, know, that was what it was.
Yeah. Well, there's other things that women, when they talk to each other, there's a really great Harvard Business article on the business school article on this. And I actually had all of my team read it this year about how men and women use language when they're talking about tasks or tasks that they've just completed. And men are using language to try to put themselves one up on the individual that they're speaking to, like higher than the person they're speaking to. Women demote themselves in order to commiserate or feel like they're at the same level as the other person. So an example is that one of the guys would say in the robot room, you know, dang it, this just burned out. This servo just burned out. And a girl who had nothing to do with the task that was being going on will look at him and say, I'm sorry. Mm. Well, she's trying to commiserate with the boy. The boy looks at her like, did you do something to this? And it causes problems with how we interpret each other in the workplace. But you can see how a stitcher will say, well, my embroidery is not too good. It's almost like fishing for a compliment in a way. And what will happen is not necessarily that the other woman will say, oh, your stitching is wonderful, but she'll say, but look at mine. Mine's even worse than yours. And it's this kind of degrading right. of our own capabilities to try to be kind of equal and compassionate to each other. And it just kind of continues to reinforce that. And we see it in the engineering area. We see it in business. We see it in how women interact together. And I think, Gary, you've really cued in on this.
Oh, great.
I think, too, I want to say, I'm going to use Facebook and probably Instagram. So all social media does this. So I have a piece and I've been working on it. And I really think there's something visually wrong with it. It's more free form. I hesitate to put it on the Facebook page where it belongs to a group because I don't want people to say, yes, it looks fine, because I know it doesn't look fine. I want constructive criticism. Does that make sense? But I think as women, we're afraid to give that, to say, yeah, well, maybe if you added this color or you did this, it would be helpful. I like this about it, but this might improve it. We don't give constructive criticism to each other either. And I think guys are more likely, or men are more likely to do that. You say, there's something off with that. Women tend to say, oh, yeah, that looks fine. Or, oh, no, it's okay. Or where it's just kind of passing it. And that, I think that furthers your insecurity, because you're looking at your piece and you're saying, well, no, I really see something wrong with it, but I can't figure it out on my own even.
Well, I have to say, Beth, you need to get on Ning, which is my social media site that's private for my courses, and put it up there, because I've socialized the group to actually do that, to give a compliment, but also to point out some different ideas, in a non-negative way. But not to just pass on when somebody is asking, for some, critique that will help them out of a corner that they're in.
So when you mix lack of female confidence, and I'm just going to make that general statement rather than qualify everything, because it'll take us a half hour. But when you mix that with what people see from very experienced stitchers on social media, then that's really a pretty bad mix, because all that says to most people is you'll never measure up.
Yeah, you can think of it that way. But I also think that we have kind of moved in a direction of getting away from play. You know, when you think about what a kid does, we call it play. When you become an adult, you call it a hobby. And we've kind of lost that sense of play in our embroidery. I think you see it very dramatically in the 20 and 30 year old set right now, who, as you said, Gary, they don't know about organizations. They don't know about structured teaching. They don't know what they don't know. And yet they're taking floss and they are going nuts with it. And that is absolutely wonderful, because they're playing. And they're expressing ideas using fiber. And, I would love to show many of them other ideas of what they could do with fiber, introduce them to a higher quality set of materials, and then see what they do with it. And I think that we have done so much work in reproductions. We've done so much courses on, Royal schools, certifications, master craftsman level things, that we've kind of lost our way in playing. And I was mentioning this to some of my own students recently. I said, I want to give each one of you a 12-year-old girl to work with you on your cabinet. Because, I mean, you can't, this is a dollhouse you're building, essentially, right? You're building this wonderful cabinet with secret drawers, and you're like, what could I do? What could I put here? Could I make a little person that's in the castle that only a couple people will ever see? What else could I do? Could I make the most amazing blonde ringlets for that lady if I used a little bit of glue with my swallow vol and put it around a stick, let's say, and, that's playing. Let me tell you about a casket that I'm going to design and make, and I can't wait to do it personally, because it's going to be the most fun, just absolute fun. I want to make a cabinet that looks like an old antique map with all the monsters all around it. And I mean, yeah, are they going to be eating salt, sailors? Probably. but it's going to have this enormous pirate ship on the top of it, standing straight up. I don't know what I'm going to put on the pirate ship. Maybe Jack Sparrow is going to be on the mast. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to have fun with it. And then it's going to be mechanically operated such that the Kraken is going to, its tentacles will go over the casket as you turn a crankshaft. I am going to have an absolute blast with it. Am I going to care as much about what the quality of the needle lace is on it? No, because I'm having fun. while doing it. And we've got to get back to that. We've got to get back to more of that.
See, that's a fear. I have my casket kit. My friend and I are going back and forth. Like, when are we going to start this? We need to get this. And I know I want to change it. I already know that, you know, I wanted to change. But there's this, the minute you started saying you were going to change, I just could feel myself get all this anxiety in me. Like, oh, I know you can do it, but like, could I do that? Could I? I'm afraid to start. That fear of the fear of wasting materials, the fear of wasting time. And it's, you're right. It's a matter of play. I play with paint. I'm not afraid to take a paintbrush and make a mess on a piece of paper. But with needle and thread, I'm a little more fearful of it.
Well, that's just
taking time to play.
That just speaks to how society has told us that women aren't worth anything. Our housework isn't worth value. Our tending of children isn't worth value. What we decide to put our time with isn't worth anything. That's kind of what society has done. And then we've internalized that. And yet my husband is going to play golf tomorrow and bought a set of golf ball, you know, golf clubs for it. He's never played golf before. I mean, that's several hundred dollar, you know, and he thought nothing of it. He didn't even mention it to me. And I'm thinking to myself, well, why don't I just do that? Because, you know, we're socialized to say that the man deserves it and the woman doesn't. Well, screw that. Start your casket.
Yeah. Well, see,
right. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah. Beth, that is so interesting to me because that's one of the things that I admire about you is you, it seems like you'll try about anything without fear.
Right.
So even in someone like you, that is ingrained.
Well, and it's funny how people say this about the caskets, because it's just the fabric that you might decide not to use. You haven't ruined the casket. You know what I mean? If the panel didn't work out, move on, frame that, do another one, another panel. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's it's the materials. I know. Well, where I live in a needlework desert. So to get a replenishment of the materials is like, oh, you know, if I quote unquote waste this thread, what am I going to do? Well, they don't always make more of that thread for the caskets, but I need to get over that because there's substitutes.
Yes, there are.
I could substitute something else. Someone else said on a blog about, they were talking about paint and paper and art supplies. And they said, if your art supplies are just sitting there, you're wasting them as much as if you put them on a piece of paper and made an ugly mess with them. And that's what I keep telling myself about my needle and thread. I have these supplies. I should use them. They're being wasted, quote unquote, by just sitting in a box. I mean, there's joy in looking at them, but it's much more fun to play with them, to put a needle and a thread together and go through a piece of fabric than just looking at them in a box.
Exactly. And you know, I was, I want to tell you about this article I read in the New York Times this weekend. There was an artist, a male artist, who had this gallery exhibition of embroideries featured in the Times. He did something like a lot of women would do. He made pictures of his friends with long stitches on small pieces of fabric on the subway. So that was cool, right? You know, he did them on the subway every day. But the way that he thought of them and the way that they were displayed just shocked me in a good way. He felt that the back and the front were equally a portrait of his friend. The back was messy. He was working it on the subway. I mean, you know, you're shaping, shaken around. And he didn't finish off his ends. So they're just hanging there. Now, okay, that's a little bit of a surprise to see that in the New York Times, the back of the piece. But they were actually hung in the gallery such that you could walk up. It was kind of like the frame was like glued to the side of the wall so that you could see both the front and the back of the glass. And you could walk up to it and look at the back. And this was considered art. And I think about how us hobby embroiderers think about the backs of our embroidery and how much time I spend trying to convince people that the back doesn't matter. And how often they are, you know, everybody, they say, well, yes, but I got this back from my master craftsman. It looks absolutely gorgeous on the front, but the back wasn't good enough. And I'm like, oh my God, you should see all these historic embroideries and the backs. They're awful. They're absolutely awful. And many times, if the back is awful, meaning a lot of thread coverage, that's why the piece survived, because it had enough material there to strengthen the fabric. So, you know, the backside is not as much of a problem as we all think. And I,
well, there's that makes another... me feel so much better.
Well, there's this, I got a picture. I've been doing this white work sampler course for a while here, and, you know, stitchers don't usually get to see the backs of things or things up close or things underneath a microscope like I do. And so they have imagined how perfect all of these things must be or godly they are. And they aren't. So a collector just the other day sent me a series of photographs of a piece. And this is just an exquisite 17th century white work sampler. Exquisite. And she knew of the kind of research I'm doing. And in order to help me out, she took high resolution optical scans on a flatbed scanner of this sampler front and back. And that was wonderful. And I started looking through it and, oh my God, reversible stitching my butt. It was incredible. This thing will be framed on the wall, right? The front of it is absolutely beautiful. You know which is the front, which is the back, because you know how there's lots of small squares of needle lace in this open work. And the person had gone from square to square, dragging the linen thread across the diagonal of the square behind the needle lace. So you might have a 3/4 inch long strand being dragged across the back, just in the area where when you look at the front, you won't be able to see it. And I thought to myself, my God, I spent so much time planning out where do I start, where do I stop so I can cover up my travels or dig them underneath bars. And here this particular embroiderer just slapped all the, you know, they just dragged them all around across the back. And I was like, I hit myself in the head, right? You know, like, why did I just do that? I think if people got to see the backs of these things, they would, you know, kind of give them a heart attack.
Well, and I'm working on Dan Rogers, and that's what stopped me. I was having problems doing the open and, you know, trying to carefully weave everything back in behind it. And that piece I've got, it's a beautiful design, but it's just sitting there waiting for me, because I'm like, and now you're like, I'm like, you know what? No one's going to see the back of these babies.
Nobody's going to see the back.
I'm gonna get that out.
There's so much like this in embroidery. And I'm going to tell you a Japanese embroidery story about perfection or not perfection. We all look at Japanese embroidery and we think it's absolutely gorgeous and perfect. I mean, the shapes are so round. The embroidery looks like every satin stitch is just exquisitely glass-like. Well, as an embroiderer of that, I, you know, sat in classes and the master came around to me and kind of hit me and was like, you're not doing that circle right. Well, it's because the circles, right, they're pre-printed on the fabric, and then you put it into a frame and you stretch it. Well, the circle becomes an oval. And like any other American, I am obsessed with covering the line, right? Just embroider over the line, even if it's now an oval versus a circle. Well, they don't want you to do that. They tell you, embroider the shape, not the line. And this really kind of horrifies Americans when they're doing Japanese embroidery, because they're like, well, that blue line shows. And they say, no, I don't care. Embroider the shape, not the line. And it really didn't come home to me until many years later when I was at an EJ National in Rye, New York. There was a Kurenai exhibition that was held concurrently. So there were a whole bunch of Japanese embroiderers from Japan in attendance. And of course, there was a little bit of that kind of showmanship going on. The embroidery is on the obi, which is the big piece of fabric that goes over your rear end of your, you know, kimono. And so they walked around the seminar in their kimonos to show off their own work on their obis. And this kind of spawned a new game at this particular seminar, which was stalking the kimono. And you'd see, because we all wanted to see, right? So you see a group of these. You can. I think Gary can already see the visual here.
Oh yeah. Oh the mental image right now is just more than I can deal with. Yes.
Exactly. You have these group of Japanese ladies, perfectly coiffed, holding their beautiful little purse in front of them, which of course they had embroidered as well, walking down a hallway, you know, kind of shuffling along in their special sandals. And then there would be a small gaggle of stooped over American women who are a little larger, struggling to see while not getting too close to their butts. And I mean, it hit me really at that point. The OB is on your butt. It's really rude to get your nose right into someone's rear end. And so it doesn't matter if the lines are covered or not. You're never going to get that close. All you can see from afar is that the round shape is either an oval or a circle. And so embroider it as a circle. I mean, this is where it all the rubber hits the road, right? If the needlework police get right. too close to your embroidery, you need to tell them to get their greasy nose off your silk
mm-hmm.
and out of your work, because it's not meant for that kind of close inspection. None of this is. And like I was doing a stump work lion the other night, and I hated it because I was wearing 5X glasses. I stopped. I put it on a chair, and I walked around the house for the next several hours. And every time I caught it out of the corner of my eye, I was like, wow, that stump work lion looks really awesome. Because I was looking at it at the appropriate distance, right? And so you have to kind of right. think about that in terms of your embroidery. What's the appropriate distance? And would other people, and A, do you even care about their opinion? Because most of them are going to call it crochet anyways, right?
Right. Or,
yeah.
Or knitting. Oh, that's knitting. Nice knitting. Your knitting is so nice.
Exactly.
Is so nice.
I don't care what they think. But anyways.
Well, see, all right, so what's evolved here in this discussion is really two paths, because we still have that path of lack of confidence that, mm-hmm. you know, that and both two paths, but both related. And then we have this other path of this, I guess, built in or imposed upon us obligation that everything front and back must be pristine, and if not, then you're not measuring up. And you know, and that's where the two come back together, is I'm not good enough. And I don't know, you know, so immediately, and I suppose this is more a guy thing, what's the solution?
Right.
You know, how do you break that mold sure. that's been in place for, you know, centuries? I don't know.
It's interesting. I think one thing is encouragement, is that, you know, doing a podcast like this, people encouraging other people to just do it, like Nike says. You know, I think that the pandemic has certainly brought our own mortality a little bit more front and center, that we might not have as much time as we thought maybe we had, because often people take the not good enough and they use it as a means to procrastinate. You know, you just get started. I had kind of a come to Jesus moment on that when I was 34. I had been an embroiderer for, at that point, over 20 years. And I lost all the use of my right hand at that point. And it was about 2 years of surgery and trying to rehabilitate to see whether or not I'd get the use of it back again. So I value my stitching time so much right now, because I don't know if it'll come back, if that problem will happen to me again. So I'm kind of working on borrowed time as an embroiderer. So I only work on things that matter to me significantly. I mean, that was a significant reason why I started the Cabinet of Curiosities course, is because I wanted a cabinet and I was going to do it and I was going to get it done before I lost the use of my hand again. And I think I think we have to kind of think about those things. We have to value what we're doing, value our own time, and just get to it.
Beth, do you feel like you can play?
That it's very hard. The freeform piece I was working on, I broke my glasses. We were on a camping trip, and I broke my glasses, so I could not see the cross stitch I had brought along. So that was the only thing I had, was this freeform embroidery piece that I was having struggling with. And I kept telling myself, because the mind was going, oh, this is ugly. You're doing a terrible job. You ought to just quit. You know, that little inner voice that you have. And I had to say, you know what? It doesn't matter. I have lots of thread. I need to move my hands. I'm going to go crazy just sitting in the car unless I have something to do. It's all right. I'm not wasting thread. It's all good. It's all good. It's still, to me, something's wrong with it. And I need to get some feedback on it. That was as close as I've gotten to playing with needle and thread in a long time. And just saying I realized, even when I finally was, I put it down and stopped working on it, I was like, it's okay. I've learned, even if it is like I'm not going to do anything more with this silly piece. I have learned some things. That's the point.
That is the point.
I love playing with the threads. I was playing with some, GIMP, and I was just couching it first because, you know, that's all you can do with GIMP. And I thought, no, I'm going to do a French knot with it. I love those huge little French knots I made with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, I got to try some more things with this because it was fun to play with.
Mm-hmm.
And I was playing, it was literally threads that I'd had for years that I was like, oh, these are so precious. No, they're not precious. They're threads. Use them.
Have to all admit that we all have stash beyond life expectancy. Significant stash beyond life expectancy. And just kind of get over it and move forward. You know, my grandmother, I used to quilt with her, and she had macular degeneration, the eye condition where you start bleeding in your eye. And so she became legally blind. She was an absolutely wonderful, precise quilter. She had more fun after she was legally blind quilting than she ever did, because the requirement to be perfect with her seams had gone away. And so she was just left with playing with fabric.
Because she had the built-in excuse.
She had the built-in excuse. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing that with the caskets as well. Women who have some, you know, like maybe carpal tunnel, or they have, you know, a neck injury, or their eyesight is going, or they've gotten kind of shaky with their, as you sometimes do as you become older, they're actually having more fun because they're just doing it and they're accepting where they are.
Yeah, but it should not take macular degeneration to free your mind.
No, it shouldn't.
Come on.
It should not. This is true.
Yeah.
And I think it's giving yourself that permission. It's saying, and again, it's quieting that inner voice that's telling you all the negative things. It's saying, you know, yeah, that's your opinion, but we're just going to keep playing. We're going to keep doing this because it's fun.
I was going to say, what's that makeup commercial that says, I'm worth it? That's how we should think. I'm worth it.
Yeah, I'm worth it. This is relaxing. It's fun. I'm enjoying it. So what's bad about it?
Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. I was recently at a, unfortunately, a funeral of a wonderful collector who... He and his wife had made the Casket of Curiosities happen by their generous loaning of parts of their collection to have the hinges and things like that casted, et cetera. And she had she has a casket that's in process. It's almost done. And she was pointing out to me at the reception after the funeral that her first panels that she started in the 80s were better than her recent panels. But behind us was a whole gaggle of grandchildren who were standing there looking at the casket with essentially tears in their eyes, looking at her rendering of their grandfather who had just passed and the dog that was his special companion and the stories of their life on this casket. They couldn't see anything wrong with the embroidery. They just saw love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to remember that.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. So what do we, and this is going to sound sexist, I can't help it, but what do we say to, I mean, there's just no other way, and I'm not going to tap dance. What do we say to women, you know, and that says, just go have fun, just go play and have confidence in doing that? You know, where do we break the mold so that they don't feel so confined?
Beth, what do you think?
Well, I think it's that I think women need to encourage women in saying it's okay to play. It's okay to make a mistake. You know, you're learning. You learn from your mistakes. I think that was an important point you made about failure. I think it's okay. You made a mistake. It's all right. Either rip it out or leave it for the next time you. So you look at it and you say, okay, I'm not going to do that one again, but, but mainly encourage each other. You know, I think that apology that, yeah, look at mine or whatever. I see it all the time in Guild. People show their pieces. Oh, this isn't good enough. Oh, this wasn't really good, but yeah, I'm just going to show it to you.
You know, I purposely, as a teacher, leave my mistakes in my photography at times, in my lessons. And I don't know if people have recognized that, meaning that I will show a picture and say, well, I tried it the first time this way and I didn't like it, so I ripped it out and then I did it this way. This is the way I think you guys might want to do it. And the purpose there is just to show that the teacher didn't know what they were doing in the first place. I have mm-hmm. to do the same thing you do, which is try out ideas and fail at it and rip it out and waste the silk and try it a different way. I also show sometimes that, you know, I drew the pattern on the fabric and I decided not to execute that area the same way I was really intending. And now that drawing is not going to be covered up. And so what did I do? And my secret is I always split stitch over the drawing with cream silk so you don't see it very well. It's still there, but I kind of, you know, covered up the mistake. And I move on.
Right.
I move on. And so I think that we all have to kind of show our vulnerability, our failures, encourage, like you said, Beth. And then I think we also have to break the mental picture that everybody has. And one thing I tell students when they are kind of really scared about whether or not they're going to embark on a particular project, you know, when they're asking me if they have permission to take a course, I tell them about how embroidery in different countries that dominates because of a teacher that came in and taught that. So let's say the United States is dominated by counted work because there was this resurgence of Danish cross stitch that came across from Europe in the 1980s, 1990s. And so everybody does counted work. They think it's easy, no problem. They are horrified and scared of embroidery, freeform embroidery. Well, if I have an Australian who wants to do a course, she will be asking permission to take the course that's counted work, because she's so scared of the counted work, because there in Australia, Jane Nicholas, et cetera, taught them how to do this beautiful freeform modern stump work. They all do absolutely exquisite work, but they're just petrified of cross stitch, which really tells you a lot. It tells you it's in our heads. It's not anything to do with skill.
Right.
And so I tell people that, and then that kind of gets them off the horse and they go, oh, but of course cross stitch is easy. I'm like, well, not to the Australians. Or, you know, the Australians will right. go, well, stump work, it's just like falling off a log. And they're like, well, not to the Americans. So
right, right.
Yeah.
So it's a mental game. We have to rewire our minds. You know, those neural paths, once you think a certain way, to change that, you have to constantly think a different thought, to change those thought patterns. And we, as women, need to, maybe stop looking at what we're doing as unimportant and see it. It does have value. It adds beauty. We enjoy it. There's so many, you know, health benefits to doing what we do, our handcrafts. I mean, they're documenting it more.
Oh, your blood pressure goes down. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, yep. I know that has happened to me. I got refused to get my platelets taken. They were like, what did you do before you came? Your blood pressure's low. Your heart rate's low. I was like, oh, I was just stitching with a friend for an hour.
I
mean,
I was in labor in my we were having issues with the birth, and I was in trouble, and my blood pressure went off the charts, and they were very upset. My husband said, put her in a chair and give her stitching. And they did. And poof, everything went right back down. Mm. So stitching is awesome.
It's amazing. It is. It's awesome. And we need to value it. It just because it's mainly women who do it does not decrease its value.
It's cheap therapy.
And I think we it is.
Yep. Well, it's until you look in Beth's basement, and then maybe not so cheap, but whatever.
We're not going to discuss that.
Oh, okay. We'll just ride right over that. All right. Okay. I can do that. Yeah.
Just slide right over that one. Yeah.
Well, I think another thing that it hits women is, and male stitchers too, is being overwhelmed with the complexity or the scale of a project. And of course, I'm running into that quite a bit with the Cabinet of Curiosities, the casket classes, is that people feel overwhelmed. And, they often will decide to do a project to get better or something in between. Probably it's for the, the cheap thrill of accomplishment, of getting something done, right? You know, a couple more Christmas ornaments right. and, you know, you'll be ready to go. Or I'll just finish this other thing and then I'll start it.
Right.
And
right.
We've had a lot of discussions about this on my social media site recently, because I'm kind of encouraging people to just get going. It's been 10 years working on this. It's time to start. And because I don't want to, you know, every once in a while someone passes away unexpectedly and I work with the family to take a cabinet back. And I feel sad about that because they didn't get to play. And
right.
So I had an experience recently. I one of my cabinets is going to be displayed somewhere and I can't talk about it other than that. But the time frame means that I have to finish a double casket in 6 months. And that's a lot of work to do. So I, after I hyperventilated for about an hour, like everybody else would, I did what I teach my children to do. Because when you're dyslexic, you tend to get overwhelmed a lot with the schoolwork. And I teach them and the robot team, et cetera, to get a calendar out, put down the major, you know, dates that you need to get stuff done and start breaking it down. Here's this panel. Mm-hmm. I've got to get it done in 30 days. How many elements are on it? Well, if I did two of these small elements a day, I'll be done in 30 days, and make a schedule and right. just sit down. And some days you'll get both done. Some days you'll get one done and you have to put it to the next day and you'll get more done on the weekend. But you just keep plodding away. And so you get these little accomplishment points, the kind of things you get with, like, you know, finishing a Christmas ornament, right? Is these small accomplishments right. that was all. And once I'm done with that little bit, I don't need to do any more because I'm on track. And I think that's the kind of thing where you have to kind of mentally, you know, tell yourself that you're doing fine. Right. I'm on track, by the way.
And I like the idea of breaking. Good.
But it's, it's only been 2 weeks, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's that third week where you miss some days.
Yeah. Right. I like your idea of breaking that down. I think that's the other thing. I think people look at the casket and they say, this is a huge project. But if you, it's like anything, if you never start it, you're never going to finish it. So
absolutely.
So just starting by doing the first panel or you know, just it's just, you're right. It's just a matter of pulling it out and saying, okay, I can do this. I can, this is the steps I need to take to move this forward or to get it started. And sometimes just writing those things down, it helps you break a project up, but no longer feel so overwhelming.
Exactly. And my mother is a prolific stitcher, but I never see her like, she doesn't have like a space. She doesn't like sit in one spot and just stitch for a long time. She doesn't have her like zone, let's say, necessarily. Mm-hmm. She has an area that she's kind of stolen out of a corner for her, you know, sewing machine. And it's late. Whatever she's doing is laid out there. And if she's got 10 minutes in between a phone call, she goes over there and does 10 minutes. And she gets far more done than some of the retired people that I know who, you know, have these big blocks of time, because she's just decided that that's how she's going to do things. She's going to steal 10 minutes here and there. And yet she makes tremendous amount of progress. And I think that's a great way to do things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And see, that's, you know, when we moved and I set up my office studio thing, that was what was kind of a primary thing, was I was going to have my needlework 3 feet away from my magazine work. And if I needed a mental break from the computer screen, I was just going to wheel the chair around and put in a few stitches.
That's awesome. That's just exactly the way to do it.
If I actually would do it, it would be awesome. Yes.
Well, I have my projects that are sitting in my purse. I have a project that's in the glove compartment. I have all kinds of projects. I have the beach project. Am I making progress? Yes. Is that particular project going to be done this year? Absolutely not. But will it be done in 5 years? Absolutely. So,
yes,
you have to do that kind of thing.
And you're at that, point of time where you have, where you're driving places, where you're sitting and waiting with students. And I always stole that time. Piano lessons were, if all three were taking them, it was an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. But there's no place close. I couldn't go. I mean, sometimes I ran and did a little grocery shopping, but most of the time I had to sit there. Man, I got a lot of stitching done in an hour and a half.
Yeah, I know. Somebody told me recently that they take their stump work that you put onto a piece of muslin that with some contact paper, you know, like a leaf or something. They take those in their purse, and they do those when they're in those situations instead of sitting, you know, in their comfort zone. And I thought that's a great way to get progress done.
Okay. You guys got my head spinning now. Okay. Well, see, I think one of my issues is I make too much of a production of starting to stitch. And several have suggested to me that I need to have a block of time that's uninterrupted. I make too much of the starting process, and I need to just not do that. One of the tricks that somebody taught me was when you finish your session, half hour, whatever, and you're done for the day, to start a new thread so you can sit down and just stitch rather than fiddling around, getting a strand pulled out and threading the needle and all that stuff. You know, start one so you can just sit down and stitch, and then you're off and running. And I do that, but I still make so much of a production of it. Just adjusting and fiddling. And I need to just force myself to just sit down and go.
It's funny, Gary. I get this mental picture here of like, you've got to have a pillow that's just fluffed up right,
yeah.
a glass of something, and all of that kind of thing, and, you know, bouncing up and down on the chair,
you have your drink.
Just getting it all right.
Yeah, that's exaggerated. It's exaggerated, but it's there's a lot of truth there. I do that, and I don't know why. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't have the pillow part, but.
And I think.
Maybe you need one.
Yeah.
And I think the thing people don't realize, right now I'm busy. I just don't have a whole lot of stitching time, and I won't for a few weeks. But so I started taking a photo. I took a photo of my start point, and I'm taking a photo of my finish point every night. And I might blog, I might not on it. But I only had a half hour. I didn't get many stitches in, and I did end up ripping some out because it was a mistake. But I know by the end of the week, end of 5 or 7 days, if I stick with the same piece, I will have progress on that piece. And I don't think people realize that, just like your mom, that 10 minutes time.
Yes.
How much progress you would make. Even if you just gave it 10 minutes a day.
Right.
You're making progress.
Right. Well, right now, as I said, because I have this deadline, I thought it was going to be 9 months. But then when I found out it was 6, I was a little, you know, I have to get six panels of a casket done, the big ones, in 6 months.
Whoa.
So I of course, I have to make the decisions, too, and write the instructions. So that, you know, sometimes you get stuck, right? And everybody gets stuck in their embroidery at some point. And I decided what I would do is I would have another panel that has a lot of counted work on it already framed up. So the front of my cabinet has background that's counted in queen stitches. Well, I know what has to happen there, right? There's no decision to make. So if I get stuck on this other panel, maybe I can't figure out what thread I want to use for this, you know, lion, let's say. I just move to the other panel, embroider that, the 15, 20, whatever minutes in or 2 days, you know, until my head gets unstuck and I can return to where I wanted to be embroidering. But I've made progress, right? And so I think we have to kind of, you know, that's how I've decided to kind of unstick myself. I was stuck for about a month on a panel.
I think that's true, too, for any embroidery. If you've got something that's requiring a lot of, like we're doing painted canvas piece, and for me, it's new, so it's a little bit more difficult. I can look at it from where I am. But I have something that's counted that's I can just, you know, you're just stitching away that doesn't require any thought. It's good to have both going. I think it's good for your brain.
Yep.
All right. This has been fun. We've got to end it. So we're not going to solve the problem, but we certainly hit some nails, I think. This has been good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Well, I think for people listening, something to think about. Thanks, Beth and Tricia. That was fun.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Tricia.
All right. And thanks to everyone for listening.